Okay, I'm here, and before we go any farther, you should know that my name is Gary Parrish, college basketball columnist here at CBSSports.com. I've worked at this place since, I believe, 2007, but I've never actually hosted the Eye on College Basketball podcast because, honestly, I'm not really sure why. In recent years, my colleague and friend Matt Norlander, he's served as the host, and he's been terrific, but I'm going to host the podcast this season, and I believe at this point the plan is going to be to record twice a week once the season begins at least, and I'll be joined on one of those times, each and every week, by a college basketball guest, either a writer or an analyst or a coach. I'm going to decide on that each week. On the other of those times, though, I'm going to be joined consistently by my colleagues Matt Norlander and Jeff Borzello, and this is one of those times, which means I should probably go ahead and introduce Matt Norlander and Jeff Borzello. Good morning, Matt Norlander and Jeff Borzello.
Well, good morning, GP, and how are you doing sitting
What's up, man?
Yeah, how are you doing sitting in the in the hosting chair for
well,
a change.
I think fine, I guess. It seems like the exact same chair I've always sat in when I've recorded these types of things. So I imagine there will be an obvious transition period, but at the end of the day, whatever. We're just talking about basketball. Shouldn't be too difficult, should it?
We are. And for anyone listening that might be like, what's going on here? Hey, GP has hosts an award-winning radio show, so he knows what he's doing. And this actually, I think, gives him even more leverage to get like a 50 word to one ratio between everyone else. You know, really, that's what it's all about.
Of course, the problem with this setup is all of those people who thought I talked too much on the previous podcast. Now that I'm the host, what is that going to do to this thing?
I don't know. The host is supposed to facilitate, but you might actually blow up the entire concept of podcast hosting and broadcast hosting in general. So this could be a pretty special. And by the way, I'm digging this. Borzello, I'm digging this like three-man dynamic we've got going on. I can't exactly figure out
different. I think I rounded out perfectly. I think I really
right?
do.
There's well, something here that I don't think we've
just
had.
Meshes better.
Well, we've done three people podcast before, but for whatever reason, this one feels a little more comfortable, a little better. Yeah. So I'm happy with the current setup. And I said good morning to you guys because just so we're clear, we are recording this on the morning of October 29th. We got 2 days before Halloween. We're just a few hours before the NBA season tips off, a game between the Bulls and the Heat down in Miami. Now, I'm working on a column for later today about the prospects who left school early but didn't make an NBA opening day roster. 47 players actually entered the draft early after last season, and only 27 of them actually made an opening day roster. What that basically means is that 43% of the players who entered the 2013 NBA draft with eligibility still remaining, they made a decision that was at best questionable and at worst terrible. CJ Leslie, Lorenzo Brown, not on NBA rosters. Adonis Thomas, not on NBA roster. Grant Jarrett, Deshaun Thomas, Mike Kabongo. So here's my question for you guys to start this, and I'm going to start with you, Norlander. Should the NCAA do something that allows prospects who maybe regret their decisions to return to school and play? Or is this simply, I don't know, a too bad, so sad situation?
Could be the latter. I'm not sure the NCAA really needs to concern itself with the decisions of 19, 20-year-olds that feel they have a chance to make, you know, long-term millions, I guess, and in the short term, decent contracts, and a chance at getting drafted. It's one of those situations where I don't see a lot of positive upside for the NCAA from a PR standpoint, and I guess from a practical standpoint, if it creates more obstacles, even if they aren't intended to be that, when it comes to, you know, their workforce, so to speak, leaving to gain a pro paycheck, even if that decision by the player is ultimately a foolish one, which it often is. I mean, you cite those numbers now. I don't have the facts in front of me, GP and Borzello, but I feel like if you went over the past 15 to 20 years, the ratio would be similar. It's very often we see not only those guys not making rosters, but then you have proven college commodities that occasionally, like Matthew Dellavedova, made the Cleveland Cavaliers roster, was not drafted, fantastic college point guard for 4 years. So you'll even have guys that stayed the entire time and have proven themselves in other realms take those jobs from guys that left early and entered the draft.
What do you think, Borzello?
If sign with an agent, can they come back?
No, I think once you pass that deadline, you are.
What did Randolph Morris do a few years ago?
It was a fax machine problem. First off, it was complete BS. All right, let's start there and acknowledge the obvious. But beyond that, it was a situation, if I remember correctly, and this was a long, long time ago. I believe that he never actually, like, somehow the paperwork that he was going to use to acknowledge being a pro didn't go through, or there was some sort of paperwork problem. I can't remember what it was, but that's how he ultimately was able to come back to school.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there is anything in place that you could do to prevent these. I mean, these guys are going to make decisions no matter what, and for most of them, even if they don't make an NBA roster, they're still going to make a decent living over in Europe. They'll be in the NBDL, so it's not like they're suddenly going unemployed, you know, right off the bat.
You know, I've seen John Gassaway toss this out on Twitter, and I love the idea. I feel there's got to be a major flaw in it, and that's why it doesn't happen. Why can't simply everyone be eligible for the NBA draft, and if you don't get picked? Now, coaches would hate this at the college level.
Like baseball?
Yeah, exactly. Coaches would hate this at the college level because they want to know their teams well before late June. But why not have everyone eligible, and then if you get picked, you're picked, and if you don't, then you have the choice to return to school or continue your pro career overseas or what have you.
I think the obvious answer would be that the membership would never go for that. I mean, coaches right now have pushed the deadline to either remain in the draft or return to school so forward and all rooted in what I believe is mostly selfish interest, which is, as you said, you know, would they want to know what their roster is going to look like as soon as possible. So the idea that you could go all the way, because keep in mind, the NBA ain't moving its draft. Like, that's where it is. And so the idea that you could, you have to wait all the way through the NBA draft and then through whatever sort of consulting process that there is to find out who's going to be on your basketball team the next year is not something I think the membership would ever agree with. The interesting thing here is that, you know, people constantly try to compare the NBA draft to, say, the NFL draft or the baseball draft and say we should do it this way or that way. What you got to remember about the baseball draft, it happens quite literally during the baseball season. So there's not so we see guys get drafted and then play in the College World Series. So there's not this 2-month period where prospects are out there dangling as possible pros, but still trying to maintain some sort of amateur status. And so I think certainly it's not impossible. You can do whatever you want to do. But I don't think it's practical given the NCAA's seemingly strict connection to amateurism.
The baseball draft is also like 1,000 rounds.
Right.
So like they need all those guys available to prospectively draft. I mean, only 60 guys get drafted in the NBA. So it's more limited, I guess I would say.
You know what? I think at the end of the day, I think both of you are right. And I decided over the weekend that I was going to write this column for the start of the NBA season. And sort of what I do a lot of times, not to talk too inside baseball column writing, but I often decide I'm going to write a column about an issue. And then I spend some time sort of like reading and thinking and trying to figure out, okay, but what am I going to say? Like, what is my opinion going to be on this? And I think over the past couple of days, I've come to the conclusion that it's not the NCAA's position to, quote, help these kids. And I only use that phrase because our old buddy Jeff Goodman tweeted this the other day after, I don't know which college player didn't make an NBA roster. It was very clear wasn't going to be on an NBA roster. He got cut, right? And so Jeff tweeted something along the lines of, the NCAA needs to do something because we need to help these kids. And my initial reaction was, okay, like, maybe, does he have a point? And then, as often is the case, when you start thinking about something Goodman tweeted, you go, no, he really has no point at all. Here's my deal. It's not first off, these aren't kids by definition. They're adults. They're young men. They may be dumb in some cases or ill-advised in some cases, but they're not kids. So we're not helping an 11-year-old here. There's a lot of kids that need help. You know, 20, 21-year-old men don't fall into that category as far as I'm concerned. Beyond that, here's the deal. People, and I think this gets lost sometimes, when you heard Because this was often the argument also against putting in an age limit for the NBA draft, is you want to save these high school players from making bad decisions. Well, the truth is, most of the high school players that turned pro, they didn't make bad decisions. They became bazillionaires. Kobe Bryant, Jermaine O'Neal, Amari Stoudemire, you name it. But beyond that, I've never understood, except for purely selfish reasons, why it is folks think they need to, quote, save basketball players. Because there are college kids every single day in this country who make bad decisions. Some of them drop out of school to go be an actor in L.A. Some of them dropped out of school to join a band. Some of them drop out of school to start their own company. Oftentimes, people drop out of school, which is essentially what, you know, an Adonis Thomas or a Grant Jarrett is doing. They drop out of school to chase a dream. And people do that every day in this country. And we don't think it's any sort of organizational issue that somebody needs to save them. It's a parental issue. Your parents should be in charge of that. Your guardian should be in charge of that. Whatever adult influences you have in your life, I think, should probably help you make that decision. But the idea that some sort of system should be in place to create you from possibly failing, I just think it's not something that we have in any other instance in this country. I'm not sure why we'd have it with basketball players. Beyond that, as Borzello pointed out, these kids, and we tend to look at their decisions as pass-fail. Like Deshaun Thomas entered mm-hmm. the NBA draft out of with a year of eligibility remaining, right. Isn't on the NBA roster. Oh my God, what a mistake. Without knowing the details, and I'm going to check on this when we get off this podcast, I bet you Deshaun Thomas is making more money this year than most college graduates, right?
Yeah, he signed in France.
Right.
I'm sure he's making a pretty decent living.
He gets to
there.
Live in France.
Like, and beyond that, he gets to live in France. So, like, I think yeah. sometimes you go, God, he's not in the NBA. That kid made a bad decision. Without recognizing that kid's probably making six figures minimum.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I think it's merely because these players, there's so much in the public eye. And there's a lot of issues that I've, in general, have with what you're talking about, in that I agree with you, in that college basketball players, by and large, don't need saving or protecting because they've been protected to a certain degree and coddled and propped up for so long, and they usually have the talents. I mean, GP, we've talked about this plenty. If you're basically good enough to be a top 100 player coming out of high school, you really got to have a devastating injury or just have to be stupid beyond belief to not earn good money to play professionally the game of basketball till you're 30.
I think that's exactly right. And the other thing is, like, we identify this as an issue, right? Or maybe not we do, but certainly some people have. Okay, so let's go back and look at the numbers again. 47 guys entered the draft early. 27 made an opening day roster. So yeah, like roughly half didn't. But we're talking about 20 people. 20 people. That's it. 20 people in the whole country who are, quote, deemed, like, made a mistake.
Some of them were, like, obviously not going to get drafted. I mean, like, a guy from Fresno Pacific,
right.
A guy from Delaware State. Like, they knew going in they're not going to get drafted.
Right, and so
– I don't think we need to save the 10 or 12 people that were like, okay, I'm definitely going to get drafted. I got to go, you know. That's like 10 people.
Right, people. It's like 10 people. So there are a lot of issues in college basketball and with the NCAA. Transfer waivers would be one. Amateurism in general would be another. I think if we're trying to fix things, this would be way down on the list of things to fix. I want to switch gears real quick to actual basketball and talk specifically about a kid who has received, I don't know if it's an unprecedented amount of attention this preseason, but certainly a large amount of attention this preseason, Andrew Wiggins at Kansas. Now, you guys know that we have named him at CBSSports.com our preseason national player of the year. I went to Lawrence and spent a couple of days with him last month. And yet there seems to be some pushback from people, not just people saying he won't be the national player of the year. Because honestly, I think whether you're talking college football or college basketball, if you take one person, hold them up as the national player of the year, and then give me the rest of the field, I'd be happy with the field no matter what sport we're talking about. In other words, if you wanted to argue Andrew Wiggins isn't going to be the national player of the year, that's a reasonable argument to make. We're talking about you got to be one guy, right? And I would always take the field over any one guy. But it seems to be that we've reached a point, as we are now just a couple weeks away from the start of the regular season, where people are genuinely suggesting that he's not that good, that he's not going to be an All-American, that he might not even be one of Kansas's best players. And where do you guys think this originates from? Why do you think, because this is a kid that we've all, you, me, Norlander Borzello, we've all seen multiple times play basketball. Borzello more than the other two of us because he covers recruiting. Every recruiting analyst, without exception, far as I know, ranked him as the number one high school player in the country. That makes him the most talented basketball prospect who isn't currently in the NBA. Where, and yet, in 2 months of people not seeing him, there becomes all these question marks about why do you think this is? Why do you think people are suddenly debating whether Andrew Wiggins is awesome or not?
Go ahead, Borzello.
I think part of it is that they want to be different, and I think people will look correct when Wiggins doesn't average 18 or 20 a game, because he's not going to do that. He's not going to. Kansas is going to be balanced. They have four guys that could average like 15 a game, and people are going to say, "Oh, well, if he doesn't average 18 a game, he's going to be a disappointment. He's going to be the next Harrison Barnes." Well, Harrison Barnes just averaged 17-7 for Golden State Warriors playoff team. So, you know, you're comparing him to a guy that's been pretty successful. So, I think people just want to be contrarians. They want to pick somebody different. They want to wait until somebody proves it, but Wiggins, to me, it's going to be clear by mid-January, February, that he's the best player in the country, even if he doesn't have the best numbers in the country. I think we're going to – the same with Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis didn't score 20 points a game, but everyone knew he was the best player in the country. I think it's going to be the same with Andrew Wiggins.
The Wiggins and the term narrative has become cliche, but the Wiggins narrative and the different ones around him fascinates me now, and I am so intrigued by this kid and what is going to become of him and how he'll be perceived heading into the season. It's got an opposite draft feel in the way that the season ends, especially in the football draft, where these guys don't play games and you'll just see names skyrocket or just drop down draft boards. With Wiggins, it's only like that in that his reputation is fluctuating among certain factions for really no reason whatsoever. I maintain that Wiggins is going to be an undeniably fun talent to watch, but I went on Will Leach's podcast recently and I mentioned this. I'm telling you, I can see it happening where we have a mini Clowney situation where Wiggins goes for four straight games and averages 11 points and seven boards, and he doesn't have a highlight dunk, and people are like, what's happening? I thought this kid was the next coming, you know, of LeBron in terms of surefire NBA talent. To me, from what everyone's written and said about what Kansas has, Wayne Selden apparently is an absolute freak. Embed is a 7-footer that can have some really big impact. GP, you yourself said he can be a really special player. Kansas is just loaded with talent as it is. Perry Ellis might lead the team in scoring. I think we just need to appreciate Wiggins for being a well-rounded player and just expect a very hefty, solid stat line and some solid highlights now and then, but he's not going to exactly consistently jump off the screen. He makes basketball look so easy. As easy as I've seen any 17-year-old do it. I mean, he's so smooth, it's ridiculous. But I'm interested to see what kind of backlash there is, and not to totally veer off what you brought up here, GP, but I'm telling you, like, I cannot believe Jabari Parker has gone this much under the radar, because there was a time when he was considered the best player in his class before Wiggins reclassified, and to me, Parker is set up to have a monster year, and it's almost oddly benefiting him and Duke that he hasn't gotten tremendous amounts of hype outside of maybe the triangle heading into.
Well, Parker got hurt in his senior year, and he like gained weight, lost some athleticism, like, and in big televised games, he looked kind of slow, and I think people were like, oh, well, you know, he's never going to regain what he, and so they dropped him to 4 or 5 in the rankings, and now you see like highlights of their exhibition game, and he looks phenomenal. He looks like a, you know, great athlete dunking on people. And you know, he's going to be the – like right now people think he's the 4th, 5th best player in the country. And he's really good. I mean, he's – some people compare him to Paul Pierce, Carmelo Anthony, guys like that. And, you know, he might be the most complete offensive player in the country.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, you know, from exhibitions. But there's no debating that Jabari's reputation – or at least his national ranking in by recruiting analysts took a hit during that senior year. But when I saw him when he was young working out at LeBron camp, I was like, God, like whatever draft this kid's in, take him number one. Like whatever draft he's – like I'm talking about when he was, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old. Like whatever – I just saw him working out, and it was scoring around the basket. It was turnaround jumpers from the post. It was just special things, and I think that reputation dipped. But when you have seen And again, they're just highlights, and by nature, highlights are impressive looking. But he looks explosive again. He's dunking in traffic again. He's dunking over people. And all of those things suggest that he's going to be just as good, maybe not as we better than what we thought, say, 6 months ago, and just as good as we thought maybe 2 years ago. Back to Wiggins real quick. I do think the interesting thing with him is A, he's not going to average the type of points that Kevin Durant averaged at Texas. And I think because he plays kind of the same position and he's in the same league and he's you know, heralded as the next great thing, people go, okay, well, is he going to be like Kevin Durant? Well, he's not going to have those same type of numbers. And for two reasons. One, as Norlander pointed out, like, he's got real players around him. Kevin Durant played with, like, Connor Ashley. Like Kevin Durant didn't have a real basketball team around him. He had to go. So Kevin is wired to go get points, and he had to go get points. Andrew's not going to have to do that on this team. So I tried to, in the column that I posted, you know, in connection with our preseason National Player of the Year projection, make it clear that he's not going to go out and average 25 points a game. Probably not going to average 20, might not average 15. But I think what Norlander pointed out was good about Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis didn't average the most points in the country. He didn't average the most rebounds in the country. But it was very clear to anybody who watched the games that he was the best player in the country. And I suspect that maybe it won't be that way in November or December. But by mid-January, February, it's going to be very clear that Andrew Wiggins is the best college basketball player in the country.
I think people are also overlooking his defense. I mean, he might be the best perimeter defender in the country right away. He's like, he's freakishly long, great athlete, and you know, he could guard anyone from 1 to 4. And I think, you know, that's going to factor into to when people look at him in conference play and he's locking up everybody he faces. I think that's going to factor into the fact that he's going to be the best player in the country.
Well, there was a time when I was at Kansas last month, and I was in a workout, and they were working. It was all defensive drills, everything they were doing, because they had so many new guys. It's just all defensive stuff. But there was a drill they were doing where they would give the ball to a point guard and ask him to bring it up full court to get him in the offense against pressure. And it was just like a normal drill that you see in any practice. And I was sort of sitting on the sideline, and you know, Bill Self was just coaching his team, right? And we get to the point in the rotations where it's, I don't know who was bringing it up the court. Maybe it was Nadir Tharp. But so he's bringing it up, and then they throw Wiggins at him full court. And Self, like, stopped whatever he was doing, and he turned to me, and he said, "Watch this MF-er." Meaning Andrew. Like, what? Like, forget the dunks, and forget, you know, can he average 20 a game? Watch how difficult he makes life right here, guarding the ball, playing on the ball, you know, pressuring full court. And I think that's something that it's a little harder to see for people who watch basketball because it's not going to be in a box score. But NBA scouts are going to recognize that. I do think it's I don't know if it's, you know, likely, but I think it's possible he's the best defensive perimeter player in the country. The other thing that's interesting to me, and then we're going to move on, with Wiggins is a lot of this sort of backlash is, I think it's just natural backlash. You say somebody's great, somebody else wants to say, no, he's not, right? That's just sort of the world we live in. But also it's rooted in the idea of he doesn't seem to bring it in practice every day, or he's not intense enough in practice. Well, almost every freshman you could say that about. On the radio show in Memphis a few weeks ago, I had Nick King, Markel Crawford, and Austin Nichols in studio with me. And I'm talking to them about, you know, how workouts are going. You got to understand they're playing on a team with you know, mostly like 4 senior guards. They've got older guys on the team. And every one of them said the practices are just way different than anything we've ever done. And so I think, yeah, Wayne Selden might be an exception. And Marcus Smart last year might have been an exception. But for the most part, the biggest adjustment freshmen make, particularly in the preseason, is learning how to practice at a level that they've never practiced at. So that just doesn't concern me. Listen, if we look up at 15 games in and Andrew Wiggins sucks, I will be the first to say, whoa, I had this way wrong. But, like, I'm not going to get concerned about practices in October. I'll wait and see what the kid does once the games start.
Yep.
Let me ask you this, because I think the Wiggins story has also overshadowed if it's possible to overshadow a story rooted in Lexington, Kentucky, is this Kentucky team that is coming off an NIT but is projected as the number one team in the country based off a recruiting class that features six McDonald's All-Americans, arguably the best recruiting class in the history of college basketball. They've already got shirts, at least in some circles, with 40-0 printed on them. Is that a realistic goal for a basketball team that is admittedly this talented?
All right, so I'm going to be maybe something of a jerk and a stubborn jerk here, but we can totally talk about it on the podcast. I don't begrudge that at all. But, oh, my gosh, I can't stand undefeated talk in college basketball until we get to, like, February, because it just doesn't happen. Like, it just does not happen. Teams do not go undefeated start to finish. Kentucky, especially after what they did last year, I understand they got crazy talent, and I think they should be the number one preseason team entering the season. But Kentucky could have their first loss within the first 2 weeks of the season at the Champions Classic. It's entirely possible that that happens. So, to me, it's way too premature. I guess you can bet on it in Vegas, which doesn't shock me because you can bet on almost anything in Vegas. But given the talent they have, it's fine to entertain. But I'm just like, can we at least get to SEC season before we really start looking if they can get to 40-0? Because we go through this so often. I mean, GP, you and I kind of had a thing. Like, we went through it with Murray State like 2 years ago. And there was no way that was going to happen. And we were talking about that with Murray State. I remember it wasn't even Christmas time yet. So I understand why Kentucky fans want to have these expectations. But I almost want to say, let's just pump the brakes a little bit. Because last year, while you weren't a preseason number one, you were a preseason top five team. And the point guard situation is obviously so different, and that's the biggest difference, I think, with Kentucky this year. But at least, you know, have last season humble you a little bit to say, okay, let's at least expect a number one seed and make it a Final Four. But to expect to run the table and go 40-0, which make no doubt about it, like John Calipari, I'm sure, wants that beyond anything at this point because he has a national championship. I just don't think it's reasonable.
I think if they get to SEC play, then I guess we could start talking about it. But, like, it's going to be hard to even get there because they have Michigan State, they have UNC, they have Louisville, they have Providence, they have Baylor, they have, you know, Boise State, Belmont. They have a ton of tough games in non-conference play. If they get through all that, then maybe we could talk about it. But right now it seems extremely premature.
Did you just drop a Providence in there, Borzello?
Yeah, Providence can be pretty good, man.
That's all. I know. I'm just
buzzing. Here's what I would say is that it's a little bit like, you know, these conversations began, and then people say, well, there's no way. And I do think, like, it's statistically unlikely. Heavily unlikely. It's a little bit like saying Andrew Wiggins won't be the national player of the year. Well, that's fine. Like, it might be Russ Smith or Doug McDermott or Jabari Parker or Marcus Smart. Like, there's so many other possible outcomes to that particular question. That it seems safe to predict against that, just like this. So, like you said, it's been more than 30 years since the team's gone undefeated in college basketball. And so, ask me right now to take $1,000. I'll bet against somebody going 40-0 every single year for the rest of my life, and I'm going to win that way, way, way more times than I lose it. What I think is interesting, though, is that where all this is rooted in, I think, is John, many years ago, I think when he was the coach at Memphis, saying that his goal was to have a team that went 40-0. And I actually think it was a more realistic goal when you're John Calipari at a place like Memphis, because you could have benefited, at least at the time, from the Conference USA schedule. In other words, once you got there, you should go undefeated in league play. Like, he did go undefeated in league play almost every year. When you move to SEC, it becomes a little less likely because you are dealing with, you know, Billy Donovan at Florida or a Tennessee team that's good this year or an LSU team that's starting to stockpile talent, whatever. But still, because of the world we live in, those quotes, even if they were dated in 2007, 2008, they carry over. And so when I was set down a couple of weeks ago in Birmingham at SEC Media Days, I actually brought this up to John. And he said, yeah, I said that once upon a time, and clearly it's a goal of mine, but he said, I don't talk about it to my team that often. But then he sort of, and John, he has these theories on life, you know, a lot of them are cliches, but some of them I think actually, you know, and these are things that I pick up on from like sitting in his practices for four straight years when I was his beat writer, when he was at Memphis and I was at the Commercial Appeal newspaper. He's got all these sort of, I don't want to call them life lessons, but sort of these like cliches that he just hammers home to players. And one of them that I could always remember him talking to his team about is reach for things that are unlikely. that are improbable, because there's nothing wrong with not getting them, because what you get in the process of that is usually good stuff. In other words, the way he used to phrase it, I believe, and forgive me if I'm misquoting John Calipari, but he would say, he would tell us guys all the time, reach for stars, and so what if you only get clouds? That's still better than what most people are getting. And so he told me the other day, like, listen, I'm going to go for 40-0, right? Of course, that's the goal. We're going for 40-0. But you know what? Damn. What if we only go 38-2? Oh, man. Like, his point being, let's strive for everything. And if we come up short, coming up short is still going to be a historical year. And I don't actually think that's a bad approach to take into a season.
Well, I don't blame them for trying to go 40-0. I mean, I think every team should try to go undefeated. I just, if we're talking about how likely it is, probably unlikely. I mean, look at the championship team, which is one of the best teams we've seen in a while, and they lost two games. So I think it's obviously more likely to do that. But if there's going to be any team in the country to go 40-0, probably it would be Kentucky.
I'd love a blind, is this a sorority girl proverb or a college basketball inspirational? I mean, that's too good. But yeah, and it's also Kentucky, GP and Borzello. So that's a huge thing. Kentucky drives so much conversation, drives so much content on our site, as it should. Calipari, love him or hate him, he continually makes things interesting, gives us talking points that are not just – I feel the 40-0 thing is a bit propped up and fabricated, but mostly it's not. Kentucky gives us genuine things that help college basketball and put it more on the radar. So, you know, again, I don't begrudge the topic. I know it's coming regardless, but to me it's – can they even get to February? Can they even get to Thanksgiving? You know, it'll be interesting to see.
You know, obviously their biggest early test, Kentucky, is going to be against Michigan State in the Champions Classic. That's going to be in Chicago on November 12th. I'm going to be at the United Center. It's a doubleheader where you get Kentucky, Michigan State. So the teams ranked 1 and 2 in the preseason coaches poll. And then you get Duke and Kansas. And it's possible that the 1-2 game is overshadowed because the other game is Andrew Wiggins and Jabari Parker both playing on the wing. Two guys who were Sports Illustrated cover boys before they ever even played a college game. Am I silly to be looking more forward to that doubleheader of basketball than whatever the national semifinals are going to bring us this year?
You're not silly, because one, it's going to be the earliest a 1-2 has ever played. And coincidentally, we're talking about undefeated teams. The previous record is late November with that undefeated 76 Indiana team. So it's going to smash that record by a couple of weeks for an AP 1 versus AP 2. I actually think that Champions Classic is probably the best regular season multi-team college basketball event in the history of the sport, given the programs, the rankings, the amount of NBA talent spread amongst all four teams that's going to be on that floor. I mean, guys like Gary Harris, who could be the best combination of shooter and defender in the nation, is going to be overlooked practically just because of everyone that's going to be there. So that's going to be a blast, GP. Like, Borzello and I, we love going to games that we can go to. We're going to go to plenty of November events, but we get it. Like, you get to go to the really good stuff. But this is the only time where I'm like, damn, do I want to be there? Because that one is going to be – I think it's just great. Guys, it's great for college hoops. That's going to be the marquee event, and it's going to really – it's the culmination of this idea with the Champions Classic that I hope that they keep going, because it's really good for the sport and for the beginning of the sport to kind of help kick off the season.
There's going to be more talent at the Champions Classic than there will be at the Final Four.
No question.
I think, yeah. I mean, because all these four teams won't be the Final Four teams, and they might be the four most talented teams in the country. You know, as you mentioned, I mean, Kansas Duke isn't 1-2, and that might be the marquee, you know, matchup of the night. I mean, the Kentucky Michigan State might be the undercard. And I think that's absolutely crazy that the 1-2 is the second best or second most hyped game of the day. I think a lot of people are looking more forward to seeing Duke and Kansas, because they haven't seen Wiggins, they haven't seen Parker, they haven't seen Seldon, Embiid, all these guys. And, you know, that's absurd that 1-2 is the undercard of the night.
It'll be the type of event that actually draws in, you know, let's be honest, a lot of people, most people, I would argue, that are watching the NCAA tournament in March aren't watching college basketball in November, right? There's football going on. It's just not a priority. And yet this will be a night where – if you're an NBA fan, you got to tune in. If you're a casual sports fan, you got to tune in. Not only because it's the two perceived best basketball teams in the country in Kentucky and Michigan State on the court, but because you do get an opportunity to see Andrew Wiggins, who's projected as the number one pick, Julius Randle, who's projected as the number two pick, Jabari Parker, who could go third, Gary Harris, who projects as a lottery pick, Joel Embiid, who I think, and I don't have any idea how Kansas is going to be able to keep him in school for a second year, but if he were to come back, he could be the number one pick in the 2015 draft. He is that kind of talent, and it's just going to be one of those really, and it, you know, when they designed the Champions Classic, I guess this is what they were hoping for, but you couldn't have envisioned all the storylines sort of coming together in this way. It's really going to be a terrific night. I'm looking forward to it. As much as I've looked forward to any regular season night of college basketball in a long, long time, perhaps ever. Listen, we got to wrap this up here in a moment. But the last thing I want to ask you guys before we go is something about an NCAA issue again. We started this call talking about kids who aren't on NBA roster despite leaving school early and if the NCAA should do something about that. Another issue that gets discussed a lot, particularly lately, is the Josh Smith issue that generated headlines early last week. He was given a couple of different waivers, A, to play immediately after transferring from UCLA to Georgetown, and B, to get a 2 full years of eligibility back, despite the fact that he has played in 3 different regular seasons at UCLA. Now people were arguing or debating or discussing transfer waivers, just like we spent most of the offseason doing. Is there a simple resolution to how the NCAA should deal with this type of stuff?
The only simple option would be give everyone a waiver, and I don't know how likely or conceivable it is. I mean, I think one person, I don't know who said this, but they said, for the first transfer, no waiver. For everything after that, you sit out a year. I think that would make sense because, you know, people say, well, if you give everyone a waiver, then people are going to be transferring to 4 schools in 4 years. And I think if you do it the way I just said, where you give people no waiver for the first one and a waiver after that, I think it could be a conceivable option. But outside of that, and I don't think a lot of people would agree to that, I don't know if there's a simple way you could handle transfers.
Here's my thing. One, the NCAA gets beaten up rightfully so over so many things. I actually think one thing the NCAA has done pretty well over the past 3 or 4 years is not be stuck in an echo chamber, realize that there are certain things that with protocol that kind of just evolve naturally to be a situation that doesn't make a lot of sense, and then they move to make changes to it. And one of those most recent examples is the new rule changes regarding hand checking in a block charge circle in college basketball. That change came on pretty quick following criticism. So what I'm saying is I actually think within a year we're going to have changes to the system when it comes to kids transferring and whether they do and don't get waivers. I think this is going to come relatively soon, which is a good thing. I don't see the downfall in everyone's first transfer doesn't result in having to wait a year. And then if you want to do it again, it's a mandatory, no exceptions, period, none, period. You got to sit a year. To me, that seems to make a lot of sense. I'm pretty sure I side with GP on this when it comes to siding with the players as it is, because then there's a natural dichotomy between players and coaches having freedom. And yes, there is a difference between being a player and being a coach and getting paid to do that. But then you kind of just, you know, that's a deep rabbit hole we don't have to dive down. But I want change soon, and I think it's going to come soon. I would be surprised with the amount of criticism and just the volume of this conversation, which to me, it seemed to transcend just the college basketball, you know, realm over the offseason. I think it's going to come. What about you, GP?
Yeah, I'm on record stating quite definitively that I am against restricting movement among amateur athletes. It's not something that we do in other less popular sports. It's not something that makes sense, I think, to normal thinking people. Now, you want to leave after every year? That's up to you. There's inherent disadvantages to transferring schools, right? Not everything's going to transfer. Your classes aren't going to transfer. You're losing friends. You're having to relocate. And that, for every other college kid in America, that's enough of a reason not to do it if you don't want to do it. And so why we think we need to have another penalty in place to hold kids to commitments that aren't really long-term commitments from the university's end is something I can't quite grasp. It's not something, and I don't mean I can't grasp it because I don't understand it. I mean I reject it. I reject it on principle. Now, I know that there would be some unintended consequences, and that's what coaches would talk to you about. I haven't found very many coaches who agree with me here. But it, again, to loop this all back around to where we started this conversation, it's all for selfish reasons. The coaches don't want to allow players to transfer without penalty because they are afraid of having to re-recruit their players or losing their players. But those same coaches, if given an opportunity to jump to a higher level for more pay, they do it almost without exception. So I think it's hypocritical and wrong. That said, I've talked to enough people at the NCAA over the past few weeks to know that there is absolutely no momentum within the membership to create the scenario that I'm for creating. I don't know that it'll never happen, but I know it's not about to happen. And so I think a nice compromise, to the extent that we have to compromise, might be what Borzello mentioned, which is first transfer, you're free to go. Do whatever you got to do. But if you try to transfer again after that, then it's a one-year sitting out period no matter what. And I think that to do it that way would – yeah, create some other issues, some that we can anticipate, others we won't be able to anticipate. But more than anything, it gets the waiver process removed because I know it's frustrating for the NCAA because what they would tell you is that with each and every waiver case, they are trying to do, quote, what's right for the kid. But sometimes what they think's right for the kid in one instance doesn't seem to be consistent with what they think is right for the kid in another instance, and it brings about criticism that I think is unavoidable. And so I don't know whatever the solution would be. I don't know what problems it might bring about, but right now they quite clearly have a very big problem with transfer waivers, and if we could figure out a way to eliminate that problem, then we could address as a sport whatever new problems existed from that. Well, listen, guys, I appreciate you being here, Matt Norlander, Jeff Borzello, for talking with me, debating with me, for creating a podcast that I hope everybody enjoyed. Now, remember, everybody listening, you can subscribe to CBSSports.com Eye on College Basketball Podcast over at iTunes. So I would encourage you to go ahead and do that. And then, you know, we'll do this again. We'll talk again in a few days. Thanks so much.